Thank you very much, Cynthia. Since you are walking out, I would like to thank you for inviting me to make this presentation here. Thank you, Dr. Daniel. What I would like to do in this presentation is to talk very briefly about climate science, because all day today you did hear a lot about climate science. But I would spend a lot more of time as to how the World Meteorological Organization is addressing this whole issue and how the programs of WMO are contributing to this issue. And here I'll be talking mainly of the WMO Integrated Global Observing System, the Agriculture Meteorology Program, the Climate Data Management Program, the Global Atmospheric Watch. These are programs of WMO. And then, of course, we have two co-sponsored programs. One is the IPCC, which most of you must be familiar with. And this is a program that has been jointly established by UNEP and WMO. And the World Climate Research Program, which is also a co-sponsored program by WMO along with ICSU. Then I'll give some minor conclusions. Looks like. When we talk of climate science, I think we have to remember that climate, the word, is not just a science in itself, but it is a science that is very complex, which is very closely linked to both Earth as well as oceans. So we may experience climate over the land, but we have to remember that the atmosphere above the land and, of course, the oceans, they are all very closely linked, and that is why we're able to make seasonal to interannual climate forecast today with a greater accuracy than we were able to do some years ago. Just to give an example as to how the understanding of the interactions between climate, land, and oceans has improved over the years, this shows the progress from the mid-1970s to the current 2000s. And what you can see here is that back in the 70s, we were only looking at atmosphere. Then by mid-1980s, we were able to bring in land surface into the equation. And by 1990s, we also included oceans. And then by late 1990s, we understood that it's more important also to look at the sulfate aerosols. And then present day, we are looking at non-sulfate aerosols and all the carbon cycle. And as we move forward, of course, we would also like to include more clearly the issues of dynamic vegetation and atmospheric chemistry. So you could see that earlier we were only dealing with weather, a very small fraction, and then we bring in the climate variability, and now the whole set of parameters here is what we need to do in terms of understanding climate science. Thank you. So WMO is actually a United Nations specialized agency that was set up in 1950. We have 189 member countries. It is UN's authoritative voice on weather, climate, and water. And then, of course, there are many climate initiatives that WMO has established. We are a major contributor to the establishment of the World Climate Program, the World Climate Research Program, the IPCC, the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, the Tropical Ocean Global Atmosphere Experiment, the Global Climate Observing System, and GEOS, which is the Global Earth Observation System. So the purposes of WMO are listed here. It's a long list, but what's very important to remember is that each of you who are receiving your forecast every morning when you turn your radio on or television on, or afternoon or evening, you need to remember that there are meteorologists out there who are working 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, all through. No holidays, no resting. Any meteorological service around the world has three shifts of staff working 8 hours. Because they are working 24 hours a day for all of you, you are able to get the forecast that you want. So that's what the whole listing of WMO's purpose is about, to foster that network of meteorological services around the world, to provide you all the observations that are needed, operational hydrology, facilitate not only processing but also exchange of data, and make sure that the data that are so collected are used for socioeconomic development, be it agriculture, be it transportation, or any field. And more importantly, more recently, we are very much interested in disaster risk reduction and mitigation, and of course, research and training. So this is what WMO does in terms of an integrated global observing system. When we talk of weather, I mentioned to you earlier that it's not just atmosphere above the land, but it's also ocean. So a lot of things happen on the ground that you probably have seen here and there. The weather stations that we have on the ground, meteorological observing station, for example, closer to cities and so on, but if you are in the remote areas, we operate more importantly automatic weather stations. Then you have satellite receiving stations and so on. And then the wind profilers in some stations. Then as you go into the atmosphere, there are a whole lot of things that are happening. The pilotless aircraft, the radio, the meteorological research aircraft, international aircraft also provide us observations, high altitude research aircraft. Then you have the satellites, all kinds of satellites that are providing information for us. And since 1980s, more observations on the oceans. And this is made possible through the drifting buoys and also the voluntary observing ships and so on. And then, of course, we're also monitoring the air pollution at a number of stations. Next please. So just to give you an idea, you know, these sort of advances, what has happened in the last few years. Back in the 1975-78, this is an example of the sea level observations. In 30 years, we have been able to make a 100-fold improvement. What this shows here is the sea level as measured in centimeters and the accuracy. This is the error back in 1975-78, and this is the instrument noise. And then now you could see here that we were able to reduce the error even below the instrument noise. So this is the amount of the advances made in terms of observations. Now let me go to the second program in WMO, which is the Agriculture Meteorology Program. Here the main emphasis, of course, is to make use of the weather and climate data to have better management of agriculture, livestock, forestry, rangelands, and fisheries. So we actually use the weather and climate data to promote sustainable agriculture management and also use them for operational purposes. For example, farmers around the world need to know when they can plant, when they can apply the pesticides and insecticides, or when they can harvest, or when they can move the produce into post-harvest facilities if there are inclement weather conditions and so on. Then, of course, the more recently we're able to start more applications towards seasonal to interannual climate forecasts of the range of, let us say, 6 months to a year, and sometimes even up to 5 to 10 years. Then we have, more importantly, recently in developing countries, promoting the issue of adaptation to climate variability and climate change. This is just an example of the kind of workshops that we organize, looking at the climate variability and climate change that published by Springer. And then we also looked at the contribution of agriculture to the state of climate. This was organized in Canada, and some of you may know Ray Desjardins, who was the senior editor of this book. We tend to reach the global community. What you have seen so far in the presentations today is research that you are doing at local research stations. But WMO's purpose is mainly reaching the global community and educating the global community about the importance of some of these issues. So we organize workshops throughout the world. For example, we organized an international symposium on climate change and food security in Bangladesh in 2008 for South Asia, and then a workshop on climate change in West Africa, and then a regional workshop for the Asian plus three countries in Beijing in March of this year. And then next month, we'll be organizing a workshop in Kuwait City for the West Asia and North Africa on the issue of climate change adaptation. This is just an announcement for that workshop. If any one of you is interested, please contact me and I'll be happy to provide you the details. What is the objective of these regional workshops that we organize in different parts of the world? First of all, of course, is to raise the awareness about the impacts of climate change on agriculture, forestry and fisheries, land and water resource management. And how can we analyze these implications for food security? Because this is an issue that is on the radar screens of many governments around the world as to how you could assure food security for large populations, and the population continues to increase mainly in developing countries. More importantly, I think it's very important to look at the issue of policy, institutional, and technical options. You may have enormous amount of research results. You may have information on hand. If there is no policy that is implemented at the governmental level, really all of that information is not being used. And that's probably one reason why in many developing countries there is still an issue of development, because of the lack of appropriate policy options. And then the last one, of course, is to look at the priority areas and the proper mechanisms for regional coordination. This is what happens typically in a workshop. We have an overview, and then we identify the issues and the strategies through sessions, for example, like the impact of climate change on sector perspective, on different sectors. As I mentioned, the policy and institutional mechanisms, responses at the agroecological level. And then we look at the issues for regional cooperation, and finally identify priority areas and mechanisms for regional cooperation. Please. So the outputs for these workshops are generally, as I mentioned, they address all these various sectors in different agroecosystems. We like to identify what are some of the priority areas that are in each of these sectors in agriculture, forestry, fishery, and so on. And then how can we promote regional cooperation? This is what is very important, because climate knows no national boundaries. Issues and problems are similar for all the countries in the region. So if there is more and stronger regional cooperation, we are probably in a better position to address these issues. And then, of course, we try to publish these proceedings very widely and then distribute it to all the countries concerned in the context of climate change. This is the proceedings of the workshop that we organized in Bangladesh. In fact, Pramod Agrawal here helped us in developing the regional adaptation framework for South Asia, which was discussed in the workshop, and then which was adopted at the workshop. Please. With this, then let me go to the next issue of how we are trying to reach farming community directly. This is something very important, especially in developing countries. So we started roving seminars on weather and climate and farmers in West Africa. This is based on a pilot project that we organized back in Ethiopia and India in 2007. And then in October of 2007, the conference of the Directors of Meteorological Service in West Africa was organized. And then there they agreed that these sort of seminars need to be organized for the farming community in West Africa. So then we organized an expert meeting in Niger in April of 2008. And then with the funding from the State Agency for Meteorology in Spain now, we have organized more than 260 seminars in West Africa since 2009. Through these, we were able to reach more than 10,000 farmers in different parts of West Africa. Typically, this is what happens, that meteorological services in the morning, they make a presentation as to what is climate variability, what is climate change, what are the impacts of climate change on the cropping systems in that region. And then in the afternoon, next slide, please. In the afternoon, then the farmers are given the option, the freedom to express whether they understand the climate forecasts that are being provided by the meteorological services. If they understand, do they apply? If they apply these forecasts in their operational decisions, is there any improvement in the crop yields? One thing that we have been doing there is to demonstrate the use of a rain gauge. This is something very known to probably everybody in this room, but not to those illiterate farmers in West Africa. So we produce these plastic rain gauges. They cost about $5. And then we show to the farmers as to how they can monitor rainfall in the rain gauge. And with that, we also give them one sheet of paper that tells them how to look at the accumulated rainfall in the rain gauge, and based on the accumulated rainfall, how to make operational decisions, whether he's going to plow his land or sow his crop or apply fertilizer or any other operation.
Is there a layer of paraffin on top that would prevent evaporation, or do you have them empty the gauge?
We, after it comes to a certain level, you could see those color markings. We ask them to empty. But those farmers who are literate in the village, we give them a little table to make observations of the data, add the data, and then keep those data available or make the data available to the entire community in the village. These sort of rain gauges, you know, it's very small cost, but we found that they have really brought in a lot of enthusiasm in the farmers, that they want to monitor rainfall themselves, and they want to use that information for operational decisions themselves. And we are now doing a monitoring project where we are trying to see what kind of benefits the farmers have actually shown in their productivity levels from the use of this information that they're gathering from the rain gauges. The next program, WMO program, that I would like to talk about is the Climate Data Management Program. In terms of climate change, one publication that is very important around the world that people really like to use, and especially the research community, is this WMO statement on the status of global climate every year. So let us say from January to November, we collect all the data on the status of climate around the world. And then by about beginning of December, we have a draft report. We normally take it to the Climate Change Convention, because the convention normally meets around end of November, early December. So the draft is issued at the convention, and then the detailed report issued is in the following February. But what's important is that this statement highlights the annual surface temperature globally and regionally. It describes the extreme weather and climate events in the year. It is reviewed by the international experts, and we produce it in 6 languages. Just to give you an example, analysis showed that between 2001 and 2010, the data, what you see here is the global temperature here on the x-axis, and these are the various decades from 1881, 1890, and all the way to 2001, 2010. And you could see for yourself how the mean temperature, the global mean temperature, increased over the decades, and 2001-2010 is clearly the warmest decade on record. So these are the sort of very simple graphical information that this annual statement provides to the users for applications. We have a commission for climatology. This is one of the 8 technical commissions in WMO. In this commission, we have task teams, for example, on climate system monitoring. There are 2 task teams that are listed here. The task team on extreme climate event, that is something very, very interesting for a research community. So this task team is led by Ren Fuman from China, and then you could see the experts from various other regions. And then we have a task team on national climate monitoring products, led by John Kennedy from UK. The third program is the Global Atmospheric Watch, and this program actually focuses on atmospheric composition away from the strong pollution sources. So these measurements, of course, are very relevant to agriculture. In this case, we look at 6 groups of variables that are related to agriculture, namely the reactive gases, the greenhouse gases, ozone, the ultraviolet radiation, aerosols, and precipitation chemistry. And you could see the Global Atmospheric Watch stations here that are fairly well spread out around the world, but as is always happens, you could see that although Africa is a very large continent, very sparse stations here. And this is what needs to be done for us to gain a better understanding of what is happening in terms of these various greenhouse gases. We need to improve the networks here. And in terms of these gases, of course, you heard already that methane and nitrous oxide are the important gases that are related to the agricultural activities, and that plants serve as a sink of carbon dioxide through the photosynthesis and also as a source of CO2 via respiration. Next slide, please. So the key issues that Global Atmospheric Watch addresses is that what are the air pollution impacts on crops, the process of eutrophication and nitrification, the contribution of agriculture to the sources and sinks of greenhouse gases, changes in the air composition due to land use, and then, of course, finally, the agricultural waste, whether you have burning in the forest or biomass burning, that actually increases the pollution, and along with it comes also the problems of health effects. In terms of nitrification, as most of you know, it is the biological oxidation of ammonia with oxygen into nitrate, following oxidation of these nitrites into nitrates. And so this is one of the major sources of nitrous oxide, and which is very, very important gas, greenhouse gas. In terms of ammonia, Global Atmospheric Watch also concentrates on this aspect, because it results primarily from the decomposition and volatilization of the animal waste. So in fact, here on this side, you could see the impacts of ammonia in terms of soil and freshwater acidification, eutrophication of the ecosystems with the consequent species loss, aerosol production affecting global radiative forcing, increases in the emissions of the greenhouse gas, nitrous oxide, and methane, and then, of course, modification of the transport and deposition patterns of sulfur dioxide and nitrous oxide. Just to give you an example of what kind of data the Global Atmospheric Watch produces, here you see that for various different systems here, rice, enteric fermentation, manure management, soils, and agriculture residue burning, you have, for example, the differences as to in 1990 to 20, what is likely to happen by 2020. Rice, methane, 4 teragrams in 1990, expected to go to 5 teragrams. Same thing for the enteric fermentation as well, manure management. And then, of course, here the total shows this is what is likely to happen, that you may have 30% increase. And the final two programs that I would like to talk about are the IPCC and then the World Climate Research Program. IPCC was set up jointly by WMO and UNEP back in 1988. And it has been 23 years since we have set up IPCC. And in these 23 years, they have done a tremendous job in terms of assessing the risk of human-induced climate change. They have described to the world what are the causes of the climate change, what are the impacts and who are the vulnerable regions and communities, what kind of response strategies do we need in terms of not only mitigation but also adaptation. And they have been providing this systematically over the 23 years for decision makers. Those of you who have seen the IPCC publications, you must have seen that IPCC produces a summary for policymakers, which is referred to very rigorously by governments around the world. Just to give you an example, what IPCC plans to do for the next 2 to 3 years, because the IPCC Assessment Report 5 is due in 2013-2014, and there, in terms of this particular symposium, we are looking at the work of Working Group 2, which focuses on impacts, adaptation, and vulnerability, and then Working Group 3, which focuses on mitigation. So compared to the Assessment Report 4, which was issued in 2007, IPCC now is putting a little more new elements in their assessment. For example, multiple stress framing is one thing they're looking at. And they're also looking at expanded treatment of adaptation. This is something that hasn't received a lot of attention in the past assessment reports. And for us to be able to cope with climate change, it's extremely important to be able to adapt. And so IPCC, working groups 2 and 3 are going to put more emphasis on this. And then more importantly, because of the stress from the developing countries, they are putting more emphasis on human well-being, security, and ethical concepts as well.
What is the meaning of ethical concepts?
Ethical concept in the sense that there is a group that is looking at the issue of, for example, responsibility, accountability. And then what you need to do, if you're responsible, then what you need to do. I mean, this could be a controversial aspect. I'm not going to put my finger on how they're going to come out with the report. But I think it's important in today's context, finally, to be able to come to the issue of ethics.
Among different levels of society,
among different countries. Because there are certainly vulnerable countries. And as you saw from the presentation from Africa earlier, agriculture productivity has gone down by 50%. So to what extent is the vulnerability going to be further increased? If that is so, then how are we going to address the whole issue? Perhaps so. That is why I think they are also looking at the whole issue of ethics. The final one that I would like to talk about is the World Climate Research Program, which is also a co-sponsored program by WMO. WCRP coordinates climate research modeling and analysis primarily to improve climate predictions and also to promote our understanding of the human influence on climate. Next, please. So these are the research priorities in WCRP, quantifying and communicating uncertainties in climate change information, focus on regional to interannual decadal climate predictions and projections, and how climate information can actually help in adaptation planning and mitigation strategies, how we can address the issue of climate risk management more forcefully, how we can promote timely, reliable, and easy access to climate information and knowledge, and finally, education, training, and more importantly, development of the next generation of climate experts. In fact, next week, WCRP is organizing an open science conference in Denver, Colorado, and there are more than 2,000 scientists coming to that open science conference, and more than 1,000 of those scientists are young scientists. So they are putting emphasis on really capacity building for young scientists in the whole issue of climate research. This is just one example of what WCRP does. This is the Global Energy and Water Experiment. And here they develop climate data records of global water and energy variables, for example, clouds and radiation and aerosols and so on. And they then complete it with metadata and also with error analysis. So what you see here is the global mean precipitation from 1980 to 2005 using both filtered and unfiltered data. And these sort of products are very, very important for the research community. Next slide, please. Next slide. And so here you could see the other another stress that WCRP places in terms of observations and models, the sea level variability and change. As an example, you could see that here you have the model projections and then the additional contributions from the potential ice sheet dynamic process. And then, of course, the larger values cannot be excluded. This is what their projections are showing, that you cannot really exclude the large values. And here is another example of the regional sea level change and coastal impacts in terms of the projected departures from the 2030 mean and the departures from the 2070 mean. And what you see clearly here is that you could see the extent of the increase in the blue color in the polar regions.
Antarctica.
And what is very interesting, this was also mentioned by Jim Jones this morning, the Climate Model Intercomparison Project. This is CMIP3. And more than 550 peer-reviewed publications appeared from this work. And what's very interesting is 1 petabyte of data unloaded. Just to make you think how many zeros after one that a petabyte contains, a petabyte is 1,000 trillion bytes.
Wow.
So now you think in your mind, after one, how many zeros appear? So that's how much of data has been downloaded from that CMIP3 work that WCRP has been doing. And there were more than 3,000 registered users for this exercise. Now, the climate projections, you know, what's the progress since the CMIP3 work? That they feel that they need more experiments to quantify the model sensitivity and feedback. And there are Earth system models in terms of interactive carbon cycles, atmospheric chemistry, ozone chemistry, and so on. And then we need increased resolution in terms of the numerical weather prediction models, and also ocean models, and also the stratosphere resolving atmospheric models. And then, as I mentioned earlier, they are placing stress on the seasonal to interannual and decadal predictions, and those experiments will be further enhanced to test a variety of the initialization techniques. Now, what WCRP is now doing is they are going into the CMIP5, the Climate Model Intercomparison Project 5, and this is again an unprecedented international cooperation. There are about 20-plus groups and 40 models that they are evaluating. This time, the model output will be more than 2.3 petabytes. Earlier, you saw 1 petabyte, so you can see how much more data is going to be generated, and then that's 100 times greater than the CMIP3. And these data will be assessed in a kind of a grid system output, and they'll be served by federated centers around the world. And there will be a single archive that will provide information to all the user community. And this archive will be available to analysts from spring of this year. So in conclusion, Mr. Chairman, as I mentioned earlier, climate science is an interdisciplinary field, and we need a comprehensive understanding of land, ocean, atmospheric interactions. What our organization does through the global integrated global observing system, the IPCC, the WCRP, the Global Atmospheric Watch and applications in agriculture, is really looking at the whole issue of climate change in agriculture and how we can address it in a comprehensive manner to not only address the needs of the global community, but also provide information to the global community. When we talk of soil and crop management in a changing climate, we have to understand that global cooperation is extremely crucial. And as Dr. Kirkham mentioned earlier in her presentation, enormous amount of understanding is now available, and this understanding needs to be communicated through global efforts, and that is why we place emphasis on global cooperation and a unified global perspective. Thank you very much. I forgot to put that slide on.
Yes, we didn't know what to do. Thank you for an extremely comprehensive, interesting, and important presentation. And now, is there any questions or comments, please? Yes. Thank you. I think this is something we are... The question is that are we taking into consideration the climate science should take into consideration the planetary movements and then the impact they have on the weather patterns. Now, this is something, you know, what we put in the area of traditional knowledge. For example, in India, you have the almanac. And the farmers in India use the almanac, which is mainly shows the planetary, you know, positions in different times of the year, and then what impact it will have.
Yes, yeah, Mars, Venus, and various planets, you know, the positions in different times of the year, and then what kind of impact it is likely to have on the weather patterns. Now, we are trying to plan a workshop that would be concentrating on climate, traditional knowledge and climate science, and how we can bring these two together. So we are already planning something like along the lines that you're mentioning, that there is a lot of traditional knowledge out there, not only in the way that you mentioned, but also in Africa. Some years ago, we did a workshop in Zimbabwe, and we had a panel of farmers on the table, about, I think, 10 of them. And many of them were using traditional knowledge, like, for example, the flowering of trees and when the trees senesce and how certain bushes either put the leaves on or senesce and so on, and how they will use those signals for their farming operations. So these sort of traditional knowledge does exist, but it's important for us to bring the two communities together. So that is why we're planning that conference on traditional knowledge and climate science. Yeah.
stand up, please, so we can hear.
In most recent decades, I have seen that the number of brain leeches all over the world in many countries have increased. As a matter of fact, we have seen here and in some other parts of the conference and some other conference, the need of more. Certainly, we are facing new areas in terms of new developments such as the satellite monitoring. But they still need fuel solutions. And we see that the number of packages is given by the service is increasing. You show a slide where you teach the people over Africa how to set up packages for their own purposes or their own necessities. What is your perception of these, setting up these kind of brain gauges, but at the same time, globally having the number of brain gauges that the World Meteorological Organization is accepting as reliable and put the information together in all these reports and in all the information that we access and use?
Yeah, the question is there is this problem that globally the network of rain gauges is actually going down in terms of the number and also distribution in a given country. Thank you for asking this question because it gives me an opportunity to describe one more initiative of WMO, which I didn't put in the slide because it is not directly linked to climate change and agriculture. But we organized the World Climate Conference 3 in 2009. And one of the important outcomes of the World Climate Conference 3, the establishment of the Global Framework for Climate Services. In the GFCS, which is the acronym for Global Framework for Climate Services, there are five pillars. The first is observations and monitoring. The second is research and modeling. The third is climate services information system. The fourth is user interface platform. And the fifth is the capacity building. What we are now doing is developing an implementation plan for the GFCS. Our initial estimate suggests that, well, we did surveys, and the survey shows that there are 70 countries in the world, out of 196-odd countries in the world, there are 70 countries that don't even have what we call essential climate services. It's because of very poor networks. Like I showed in Africa, for example, a large gap. So these 70 countries, we would like to bring them into the next level by enhancing their observation networks. So we will be investing something like $70 million over the next 4 years to bring these 70 countries to the next level where they will have a reasonable observation network and where they will be able to provide a reasonable level of services. And out of the 70 countries, there are 6 countries, for example, like Somalia and Djibouti and others, which have absolutely nothing, zero. So, but there are people living there, they need information. So this is something that we are addressing through the GFCS.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.